Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. We are in the throes of the constitutional ratification debates. And we just wrapped up South Carolina for the second time, unfortunately. But anyway, it is what it is. What we want to do, and it sounds like we got a helicopter heading this way, so I'm probably going to be under fire really quick. Anyway, as you know, the show is sponsored by RepublicReview.org, and you are listening to the only show that provides you the academic-based evidence and solutions, and this is why these ratification debates are so important. And more important, that we want you to consider, because I know, and I've gotten a few pings from people regarding the this tyrant, this treasonous tyrant that is an unconstitutional president that is causing this constitutional crisis to get even worse. Well, he couldn't be more wrong. And as a matter of fact, but it doesn't matter. They have stolen the election, and they are comfortable with the concept that America is too civil to be able to step up. And in some ways, I kind of like that idea. But when we look at their following, when let's just be clear. The progressives, when they look at their opponents, the conservatives are too civil. You know, there's never been a conservative effort to try to assassinate a wacko like FDR or like Wilson and some of these other bad players. If you look at the presidents that have been actually assassinated or attempted to, that's always been those conservatives that are not willing to buy into the anarchy and the tools of communism to move this country away from liberty. And so when we look at Biden and the rest of the progressives that are in power and the Chinese Communist Party and all of those who are players at this point in time in American politics to try to throw us off the cliff, well, I'm here to tell you, my friends, that the fact is that they do not care about our positions because they believe we won't do anything or we will not be able to mount an offensive that can actually stop them. This is how arrogant they are. If you want to mount an offensive that will actually try Biden, Harris, Schumer, and all of these progressives, we must convene a Republic Review. We must initiate the process of Republic Review. We've got to wake up the state legislatures to move this country back into restoring our constitutional republic. I need to find that video, and I think that's what I'm going to do, is I'll find that video of Gandalf going into the kingdom of Rohan and waking up the king of Rohan by breaking the spell because the states are under a spell. Anyway, the reason that drives all of this is because this one line that I've been poked on, the Constitution is not absolute. And I'm here to tell you that the Constitution is absolute. It is the supreme law of the land, and it is not malleable or changeable. It's not, you can't make changes to it unless the states authorize it. But this is how far outlandish, and this is how whacked these progressives are, because they believe they can do anything because they won an election. There is no power granted in making changes to the Constitution because of the outcome of an election of any public servant. I want you to understand that they are tied to having, because every public servant must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. And so they don't have a choice, and what they're doing is flagrant treason, or at least at a minimum, open rebellion. This is why Section 3 of the 14th Amendment is so important, and Article 4, I think it's Section 2, the clause of treason in Article 4 for the states to use their power of declaring treason or charging their senators and their representatives of treason. Once we get the right amount of legislatures in Congress to actually do their job, and we can only do that when we have enough state legislatures demanding that the federal government comply. This is how we tip the scales. We don't do this via an election. We do this through the audit and enforcing the Constitution. This is how we get rid of and purge the ranks, and this is how we start actually implementing these qualifications. If you don't support the Constitution, you're committing moral perjury, and you are gone, and we start enforcing Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. Now, I know Mike Adams, he's a podcast host, and there's other people that have kind of picked up on this idea that we've been talking about for a long time called the Constitution, and they're learning about these little things like Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, which is good. I'm okay with educating people, and I'm okay with leading, but I'm not okay with just sitting back and basically calling everybody to do nothing. I think that anybody that goes into the argument and the debate with the Convention of States and says, don't do anything, do nothing, or they champion the concept of nullification, are just as culpable and just as bad in causing harm as those who are calling for the convention. They both have blood on their hands, as far as I'm concerned, because we're in this mess because we're not having an honest dialogue of what do the states do when their constitution is being violated. We go through this all the time with Madison. But I just want to let you know that those who have the ultimate say are the state legislatures, and that the Constitution is absolute. I just want you to understand that. We have a comment line, 425-270-5416. So if you've got a question, something that has been befuddling you, or a quandary that you're facing regarding the Constitution, by all means, give us a call. And we will air your comment, and we will answer your comment, as we promise we will. And so what we do want to do is we want to get into the ratification debate. So as we move into Massachusetts, let me kind of give you a summary. The Massachusetts Convention met in Boston from January 9th, 1788, to February 5th, 1788. And what they basically did was they had 370 delegates in that convention that actually made the final vote. And so in attendance at the convention for the arguing for the proponents was Caleb Strong, Rufus King, and Nathaniel Gorham. And they were joined by, and actually these guys were the delegates of Massachusetts at the Constitutional Convention. And so they were also joined by Fisher Ames, who it has a great history, James Bowden, Francis Dana, and Theophilus Parsons, all of which were defending the Constitution. The fourth delegate, and I said this before, the fourth delegate to the Constitutional Convention, Elbridge Gerry, did not actually go. And actually, he declined to sign the Constitution, just like George Mason. I think he basically said the same thing. He'd rather cut off his right arm than sign that thing. He was not in attendance to the Constitutional Convention. However, within the first week of the convention, the ratification convention in Massachusetts, a motion was passed that Honorable Elbridge Gerry be requested to take a seat at the convention to answer any questions of facts from time to time. So he was asked by the opponents to the convention. They said, hey, we want our shining star, the guy that's going to lead us in fighting this Constitutional Convention or this ratification. So Gerry agreed to the invitation, and he actually never made it to the floor of the convention. And after January 19th, he basically disappears altogether. This really rode him hard. I mean, Eldridge Gerry, it took a while for him to regain favor in politics because, I mean, the Federalists, who were proponents for the Constitution, weren't very happy with the fact that he said the things he did. And then the Anti-Federalists were not happy because he wasn't there to help them. So he kind of, you know, I'll just say kind of pissed off people on both sides. So one of the things that, you know, they get into towards the end of the session is basically, this was on like January 31st, the recorder of the ratification debates basically stated, the conversation on the Constitution being ended, Mr. Parson moved that this convention do assent to and ratify this Constitution. I think at that point in time, they had made what they felt was the necessary changes in the paradigm of the delegates of Massachusetts. I will tell you that John Hancock, because one of those people that was suspected as an anti-federalist was Samuel Adams. And so John Hancock, who basically did not attend the convention, hardly at all, he was the president, but was not in attendance. And actually, I won't have enough time to close this out, but we will close this out and get into these debates as soon as we go through these two promos. So we'll be right back after these two promos. Thank you so much. Have you taken the time to watch our presentation on YouTube that provided an irrefutable argument of what we have to do to save our Constitution and our Republic? I know it's over an hour and 30 minutes, but you only need to watch the first 30 minutes. If you take the time to watch this presentation, I promise it will change your paradigm regarding what our Constitution is and what we have to do if we are going to save it, our liberties, our sovereignty, and our Republic. We already have answers to most of the questions that you might think of after watching this presentation, and we want to help you get to a point where you have a profound understanding of the audit and republic review process. This is why our bullet overview and flowchart of both the argument and process is available on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. The sooner you get informed, the sooner you can get involved and make an impact. So go to ReclaimingTheRepublic.org to the Take Action page. That's where you'll find the video. Thank you so much. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416.
Okay, so let me get back to what I was basically saying in regarding Mr. Hancock. Now, Mr. Hancock was really quiet. And as a matter of fact, some of the most important discussions actually happened towards the end because Mr. Hancock, like I said, did not attend until January 30th, other than the very beginning when they elected him as the president, because of gout, and that he announced his stance on the Constitution to accommodate the opposition by suggesting that amendment proposals be annexed to the ratification. So in other words, it was Mr. Hancock that really helped people go, you know what? there's nothing that says we can't. I mean, they knew that they couldn't formally provide amendments, but they could informally say, instead of saying, well, we're going to do this contingent, because a lot of the conventions in Virginia, they went down the exact same path. They said, well, maybe we should make contingencies. If they will amend the Constitution with this, we will ratify it, or something like that. And it really came down to, in each of the debates, the delegates, and I should say those who were leading in these debates, were clearly identifying the fact that they didn't have the power to create a conditional ratification. What they had to do was either ratify or reject. And so what they could do was they could ratify with proposed amendments, which means that they still put a check in the box. The other alternative was to not ratify, but to send amendments based on the condition, if these amendments are passed, then are provided, we will ratify. And so that was not putting a check in the box. So they basically said, hey, either we reject this all out, or we ratify it all out. You can't have it both ways. And so anyway, I found it really interesting how this same debate, even after Massachusetts had done this huge compromise, how the same debate was being repeated in the other states, specifically Virginia. Because if you've ever listened to, I think it's Paula Myers, Ratification of the U.S. Constitution, she really focuses a lot on the Virginia ratification debates. Or actually, there was another book, I think it was Gutzman that wrote a book that talked about Madison's quest for the Bill of Rights, which covers the ratification debates as well. And so anyway, you'll find when you start looking at some of these historical views of the ratification, the Bill of Rights, and so forth, you'll start realizing how the arguments were pretty much the same, and they were denned based on the same kind of conclusions that, bottom line, we have a job as the delegates of this state to either ratify or reject. And so those who were selected to do the job, they didn't allow some of the opponents, like Patrick Henry and George Mason and so forth, to derail their efforts. Anyway, I'm just going to get into the ratification debates at this point. So one of the first things that we really want to cover, and actually, like I said, for the first week or so, there was hardly anything that was really noteworthy that jumped out. Now, on Thursday, January 17th, Mr. King started talking about welfare. And so the third paragraph of the second section being read, Mr. King then stood up and rose to explain it. There has, says he, been much misconception of this section. It is a principle of this Constitution that representation and taxation should go hand in hand. This paragraph states that the number of free persons, including those bound to service for a term of years and excluding Indians not taxed, 3/5 of all other persons, these persons are the slaves. By this rule, our representation and taxation be apportioned. And it was adopted because it was the language of all America. According to the Confederation ratified in 1781, the sums for the general welfare and defense should be apportioned according to the surveyed lands and improvements thereon in the several states, but that it hath never been in the power of Congress to follow that rule, the returns from the several states being so very imperfect. And so he kind of starts laying out what this, you know, what this concept of welfare within the general welfare meant within the Constitution. And so heading down a little bit further, Mr. King goes on, and actually I think this is, yeah, this is January 21st. This is a Monday. And he says this, "We now come, sir, to the consideration of the powers with which the government shall be clothed. The introduction to this Constitution is in these words: we the people, etc. The language of the Confederation is we the states, etc. The latter is a mere federal government of states. Those, therefore, that assemble under it have no power to make laws to apply to the individuals of the states, confederated. And the attempts to make laws for collective societies necessarily leave a discretion to comply with them or not. In no instance has there been so frequent deviation from first principles as in the neglect or refusal to comply with requisitions of the general government for the collection of monies. And so if you're looking at what and how he's presenting this, he's basically indicting the existing system, that the existing system was inept. People were at, it was an individual discretion and the state's discretions, whether they wanted to apply to or comply to anything that was coming from the Continental Congress, this supposed general government that was serving the Confederacy. And so I hope you start understanding that when we talk about the importance of the failure of the Confederacy, as we've read through in South Carolina, and now in this, and in the future debates that we're going to go through, I just want you to understand that these men were very well aware who the problems were. And the problems were the states. That the states had to delegate very specific power to the general government for it to be able to do very specific jobs, such as national security, fighting wars, and so forth. Now, Mr. Dawes is the one that basically starts talking about commerce, and this is just a little bit later on the same day, Monday, January 21st. As to commerce, it is well known that the different states now pursue different systems of duties in regard to each other. By this, and for want of general laws of prohibition through the Union, we have not secured even our own domestic traffic that passes from state to state. This is contrary to the policy of every nation on earth. Some nations have no other commerce. The great and nourishing empire of China has but little commerce beyond its own territories, and no country is better circumstanced than we for an exclusive traffic from state to state. Yet even in this we are rivaled by foreigners, by those foreigners to whom we are at least indebted. A vessel from Roseway or Halifax finds as hearty a welcome with its fish and whalebone as the southern ports, as though it was built, navigated, and freighted from Salem or Boston. And this must be the case until we have laws comprehending and embracing all the states in the Union as far as how trade was to be done. So in understanding commerce, the federal government did not have the power to regulate what kind of products were going to be made. It only had the products of how, or it only had the control in regulating how the tariffs would be applied amongst the states externally and back into the states, and created a uniform standard of basically trafficking or flowing commerce throughout the states as well as to abroad and back. Because bottom line, the general government's primary source of income was taxation, imposts, and duties on trade. Okay, so when people say that, well, the power to regulate commerce did not mean that they could dictate how you had to make a product, that you had to have a product that met environmental standards or anything like that. Anyway, so Judge Sumner's, and let me see, this is the next day, Tuesday, January 22nd, he starts off and starts talking about delegated powers. The powers proposed to be delegated in this section are very important, as they will, in effect, place the purse strings of the citizens in the hands of Congress for certain purposes. In order to know whether such powers are necessary, we ought, sir, to inquire what the design of uniting under one government is. It is the national dignity may be supported as safety preserved and necessary debts paid. Is it not necessary, then, to afford the means by which alone those objects can be attained? Much better, it appears to me, would it be for the states not to unite under one government, which will be attended with some expense, than to unite and at the same time withhold the powers necessary to accomplish the design of the union. And so we'll take a break right there. We'll actually repeat that last sentence. And we will be right back as they start going through the delegated powers and how important it is in creating a government that possesses the necessary powers to do its job. Imagine that. Anyway, we'll be right back after this.
If you run a business or an organization, you already know email is an essential tool for communicating. If you're interested in reducing your overhead and increasing your productivity, I personally recommend you look into AdLocal email marketing services. AdLocal has a special offer for my listeners with email services that start at $10 a month for your first 1,000 addresses. If you want to increase customer retention, grow your market presence, track your statistics, and improve your engagement with your customers with modern, elegant emails that express the personality of your business with emails that integrate with your website, you need to contact AdLocal, and they handle the rest. Take it from me. AdLocal offers the best solutions for all organization sizes, and they lead with their pricing and the 24-hour customer service. Folks, it's time to call AdLocal at 866-88-ADD-LOCAL or visit them on the web at www.addlocal.com. To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath even though we're not required to take it because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station. Don't forget, you can call our 24-hour comment line to ask a question or to speak on any topic. Dial 425-270-5416.
Okay, so getting back to where I had just left off. Okay, so again, this is Judge Sumner, and he's talking about ensuring that they actually provide the necessary powers, the delegated powers, which are necessary for government to do its job. Much better, it appears to me, would it be for the states not to unite under one government, which would be attended with some expense, than to unite and at the same time withhold the powers necessary to accomplish the design of the union. Gentlemen say, the power to raise money may be abused. I grant it. And the same may be said of any other delegated power. Let me point out that he should have emphasized that absolutely, things can be abused, but that doesn't mean that people are in compliance with the law and the Constitution. In other words, you have these Ten Commandments. Does that mean that people won't kill each other? No. That means that the laws will be violated. There is a good chance that this Constitution could be violated. So what? We already know that the Articles of Confederation are being violated. So what? We have to use the mechanisms, as Madison and Jefferson pointed out in the resolutions of 1798, what has to be done if we're going to hold the government accountable and keep them in compliance. That's the state's job. The states have been lulled into thinking they have no job here other than taking money and being constrained by the federal government. He moves on and says, our general court have the same power, but did they ever dare abuse it? Instead of voting themselves six shillings and eight D's, I don't know what that is, but they're talking about pay, they might vote themselves 12 pounds a day. But there has never was a complaint of their voting themselves more than what was reasonable. If they should make an undue use of their power, they know a loss of confidence in the people would be the consequence, and that they would be re-elected, and this is one security in the hands of the people. Now, let me just add to this, that when we look at Congress today, it is the least trusted of all of government, and yet people keep on getting re-elected. What, do we just trust our guy? There are way too many people, there are way too many fools that believe term limits is what reels all of this in. No. Compliance, forcing these folks to comply to the Constitution is the key. All I can tell you is that when we start demanding full compliance and getting rid of those who are committing moral perjury and getting rid of those who are not supporting the Constitution, then we are on a path of restoration. Because bottom line, you know, there's lots of people that think they might be able to get away with something, but after a while, when people constantly see heads roll and people being thrown out of office because they're violating their oath of office by doing something that is not in compliance with the Constitution, because we're now watching them, because Republic Review has taught this nation what compliance truly is, what they can do and what they can't do, it all of a sudden changes the game. It all of a sudden puts us back centered. And I'm going to tell you something. I've said this time and time again, that once Republic Review goes through its course, America will institute education and will institute these checks and balances to ensure that the federal government never again frauds the American people and other nations in getting people to think that, hey, you know, if we can just get our debt to a point of out of control, we can just collapse our system. No, they can't. Well, they can in violating the law, but if we hold them to the law, then we can reset our debt, we can reset this entire nation and hold. And what we need to do is we need to point out to the inhabitants of these other nations how their leaders have been throwing away all of this bad money to try to destroy us. Anyway, getting back to welfare, though, Mr. Phillips, or the Honorable Phillips of Boston, basically rose. He says, this is how it was phrased, I rise to make a few observations on this section as it contains powers absolutely necessary. If social government did not exist, there would be an end of individual government. Therefore, our very being depends on social government. On this article is founded the main pillar of building. Take away this pillar, and where is your government? Therefore, I conceive in this view of the case. This power is absolutely necessary. There needs to be a suspicion that this power will be abused. But is not all delegation of power equally dangerous? If we have a castle, shall we delay to put a commander into it for fear he will turn his artillery against us? My concern is for the majesty of the people. If there is no virtue among them, what will Congress do? If they had the meekness of Moses, the patience of Job, and the wisdom of Solomon, and the people were determined to be slaves, sir, could the Congress prevent them? If they set heaven at defiance, no arm of flesh can save them. Sir, I shall have nothing to do in this government, but we see the situation we are in. We are verging towards destruction, and everyone must be sensible of it. I suppose the New England states have a treasure offered to them better than the mines of Peru, and it cannot be to the disadvantage of the southern states. Great Britain and France come here with their vessels instead of our carrying our produce to those countries in American vessels navigated by our citizens. When I consider the extensive sea cost there is to this state alone, so well calculated for commerce, viewing matters in this light, I would rather sink all this continent owes me than this power should be withheld from Congress. Mention is made that Congress ought to be restricted of the power to keep an army except in time of war. I apprehend that great mischief would ensue from such a restriction. Let us take means to prevent war by granting to Congress the power of raising an army. If a declaration of war is made against this country and the enemy's army is coming against us, before Congress could collect the means to withstand this enemy, they would penetrate into the bowels of our country, and everything dear to us would be gone in a moment. Now, as I read that, I want you to think about the penetrating into our bowels on our southern border, and what is happening, and how treasonous Obama, Bush, Clinton, Biden, all of these people have been in allowing this invasion to permeate into this nation over the past several decades. Moving on, the Honorable Mr. Phillips says, the Honorable Gentleman from Topsom has made use of an expression, quote, oh my country, close quote, from an apprehension that the Constitution should be adopted. I will cry out, oh my country, if it is not adopted. I see nothing but destruction and inevitable ruin if it is not. The more I peruse and study this article, the more convinced am I of the necessity of such power being vested in Congress. The more I hear said against it, the more I am confirmed in my sentiments of its expediency, for it is like the pure metal. The more you rub it, the brighter it shines. It is with concern I hear the Honorable Gentleman from Topsom making use of language against the gentleman of law. Sir, I look on this order of men to be essential to the liberties and rights of the people, and whosoever speak against them as speaking against an ordinance of heaven, Mr. President, I hope every gentleman will offer his sentiments candidly on this momentous affair, that he will examine for himself and consider that he has not only the good of this commonwealth under consideration, but the welfare of the United States. And the use of the United States was, of course, capitalized. But keep in mind, as we kind of look at, you know, these powers and the necessary powers and how in this debate they say, we, you know, these are good, we need to grant these, we have to do this. They didn't really necessarily go through, like in the Virginia and the North Carolina and some of the other debates, how they said this is all they can do. In other words, the Bill of Rights was not really much of a discussion as prominent as it was in Virginia and the Carolinas and so forth. Anyway, guns. Here we go. Here's something on guns from Mr. Sines. I humbly submit it, sir, whether if each state had its proportion of some certain gross sum assigned according to its numbers, and a power was given to Congress to collect the same in case of default in the state, this would not have been a safer constitution. For, sir, I also disapprove of the power to collect, which is here vested in Congress. It is a power, sir, to burden us with the standing army revenous collectors and harpies from another state to state. But who, however, we're going to just rush. So let me just finish this when we come back from this next break. And we will be right back after this. Thank you so much.
To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires two-thirds of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. Folks, as you know, online fraud is on the rise, and it's more important than ever for your new and existing customers to be able to determine whether they are using a website with a secured connection. If you didn't know, Google mandated in 2017 that all data submitted to its linked websites must be secure with SSL certificates. Without SSL certificates, your site is listed by Google as not secure. In other words, without these certificates, your site will be harder to find, and this will impact new traffic and ultimately your revenue. Whether you're a blogger or in e-commerce, AdLocal will help protect your website from all forms of data breaches, phishing scams, and build a secure environment for your businesses, big or small. Contact AdLocal by calling 866-88-ADLOCAL or visit them on the web at www.adlocal.com for custom pricing. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so I just want to be clear. This is more of an anti-federalist, or actually he is an anti-federalist, but what I want to do is I wanted to provide an insight of how, I'll just say, absurd the anti-federalists were making their argument in saying that this is going to lead to abuses of power. Just like everybody else before this was saying, yeah, of course they can abuse the power, but we have to hold them accountable to this. Anyway, let me finish what he's saying here. For sure, I also disapprove of the power to collect, which is here vested in Congress. It is a power, sir, to burden us with a standing army of ravenous collectors. Now, I want you to understand, if you've read my article, what is the real problem? Because we talk about standing armies, or I talk about standing armies in that article, you understand that the whole point that the Constitution did not allow the federal government to collect their own taxes. Who was to do that? To execute the laws of the Union, that was to be done by the militia. In other words, they couldn't create a standing army. If he understood the Constitution that he was reading, he would have understood that the federal government would be reliant upon the states and the people to enforce the federal laws and the Constitution, therefore allowing a check on federal government to ensure that those laws and taxes were appropriate. Now, the only way they could actually get into an abusive relationship is one to lie and convince people that what they're doing is legitimate when it is not, and basically pervert and twist the meanings of the Constitution. And the best way to do that is not to allow the ratification debates to see the light of day. Because then people can't understand. Well, hold on. How did they describe this? How was the Constitution sold to the states? Well, if you don't know, then they can make it up as they go along. And that's exactly what they've been doing. Anyway, he's talking about collectors and harpies, and perhaps from another state, but who, however, were never known to have bowels for any purpose but to fatten on the lifeblood of the people. In an age or two, this will be the case, and when Congress shall become tyrannical, these vultures, their servants, will be the tyrants of the village, by whose presence all freedom of speech and action will be taken away. I mean, I'm sorry. When you start reading some of these anti-federalist comments in context to the Constitution and these checks and balances, this becomes real drama material, if you know what I mean. So anyway, Mr. Pierce now is going to get into what I'm going to presume is basically some jurisdiction. While I am up, Mr. President, I would make some observations on what has been passed over, as I think it is within the orders of the House. The Honorable Mr. Sedgwick said, if I understood him right, that if he thought that this Constitution consolidated the union of the states, he should be the last man that would vote for it. But I take his meaning to be this. According to the reasoning of Mr. Ames, that it is not a consolidation of the union because there are three branches in the union, and therefore it is not a consolidation of the union. But, sir, I think I cannot conceive a sovereignty of power existing within a sovereign power. Nor do I wish anything in this Constitution to prevent Congress from being sovereign in matters belonging to their jurisdiction. In other words, only Congress has the power to make laws in pursuant to the Constitution. The President is to enforce them, and the Supreme Court is to determine whether those powers actually exist. And in doing so, the only way the Supreme Court could literally do its job appropriately is by using the ratification debates, which is what they have never done. Moving on, he says, for I have seen the necessity of their powers in almost all instances that have been mentioned in this convention, and also last winter in the rebellion. I thought it would be better for Congress to have stilled the people rather than the people from amongst themselves. Who are more apt to be governed by temper than others, as it appears to me, were in the Disqualifying Act, as in my opinion, when they did not keep strictly to their own constitution. And I believe such a superior power ought to be in Congress. But I would have it distinctly bounded, that everyone may know the utmost limits of it. And I have some doubts. Well, to be honest, my friends, I'm injecting here. You have that in the ratification debates, what these men are talking about. All you have to do is utilize and shine the light on the ratification debates, and you can understand how their limits are bound. And I have some doubts, moving on, I'm getting back to what he's saying, and I have some doubts in my mind as to those limits, which I wish to have solved. I have also an objection to the term for which the Senate are to be in office, for they are a democratical branch of the federal legislature is to continue in office 2 years, and they are only to check on the federal, and they, the Senate, to continue in office for 6 years. They will have an undue influence on the democratic branch, and I think they ought to continue in office for no longer than the other, and also that if they conduct ill, we may have a constitutional revolution as a short period as 2 years if needed. The Honorable Mr. King said some days past that the Senate going out by classes, if rightly considered, were not for 4 years, because one third part was never more than six, another four, and a third two. Therefore, the medium was four. But I think that the way of arguing would argue that if they were to all go out at the end of 6 years, they were but 3 years in office, because half of their time they were under the age of 3 years and other half of the age of 3 years in office. Therefore, his arguing to me in that respect was not well-founded. Now, to be honest with you, the fact that he's talking about these terms and under 3 years and over 3 years regarding a six-year term, I apologize if this kind of clouds what we're talking about. But this is the perspective of how they wanted to get into the nuances. To be very clear, the Senate was divided into three classes that every 2 years that they would elect a senator, one-third of the Senate would be up for election every 2 years. This way, there was going to be a level of continuity. Why did they perceive the necessity of continuity? Because of the understanding of trade and treaties and the Senate's job. What basically they boiled into, and not understanding the differences between the House of Representatives and the Senate, the jobs were completely different. The Senate was to basically manage, as representatives of the state, you know, the trade treaties and ensuring commerce treaties were being put into effect that would benefit them, benefit all of the states, and so forth. I don't understand why people have this confusion and why, you know, when you look at a politician as a bad player, then you have a bias. When you look at we the people in allowing politicians to be bad players, then we put aside the bias and we recognize that it is our job to keep them in compliance. It doesn't matter who's benefiting or not. Somebody is not benefiting. Does that make sense? In other words, your congressman may be bringing home pork barrel, you know, all sorts of money because, you know, and as a good case in point is the TARP bailout. The TARP bailout was built trillions of dollars, but that only benefited New York. Why is it that that was a good thing? It wasn't. It was a violation of the Constitution, and it hurt most of the union and only benefited a very small fraction of the union. We must hold them in compliance. And in so doing, it keeps them from being able to, you know, to abuse their power. It forces them to actually behave and act properly. Plus, it keeps our risk of undue taxes and undue tyranny and undue laws down to where they become non-existent. Over 95% of all of our problems that we are facing at all different levels come from the federal government's noncompliance. In tandem and in dovetailed with how local and state governments are following that. When I tell you this, and I only got half a minute, when I tell you this, you must understand that when when the federal government is actually creating unconstitutional powers, and then they're going down to the state to say, you must create an environmental agency to interface with us, a Department of Transportation, a Department of Housing, a Department of Labor, and all of these things are unconstitutional for the federal government to do, and it's equally unconstitutional for the federal government to mandate that your state interface with them with these unconstitutional powers. This is why you have to look at your state constitution with scrutiny to realize, hey, there's a whole bunch of stuff here that we're doing. We're spending money on government that is unnecessary and unconstitutional and tyrannical. We'll be back with more on the Massachusetts debates. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org. And let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.